Hello, this is Monocle Reads. I'm Georgina Godwin. Today I'm speaking to a London-based cultural critic, researcher and writer. She's the author of the 2021 essay Replace Me, and her work has appeared in publications such as The Baffler, The Believer, Granter, Los Angeles Review of Books, The New Left Review, New York Times Magazine and The White Review. Her new book is Meat Love, An Ideology of the Flesh, a long-form essay looking at meat, love and class, and the relationship between capitalist desire and the desire for meat. Amber Hussain, welcome to Monocle Reads.
Thank you so much for having me.
I have to ask, first of all, obviously, do you eat meat?
I don't eat meat currently. I have eaten a lot of meat in my life, and I sort of begin the book there with my own sort of prior desire for meat.
Well, tell us about that.
So the book sprang from, I began to write the book after I hadn't been eating meat for a while. And that wasn't because I had some kind of moral epiphany one day, or because I decided that, you know, today was the day I was going to take this strong political stance on something I hadn't thought about before. It was more kind of a gradual process. And for a long time, I had eaten meat without kind of questioning it particularly. Then in more recent years, probably in the last decade or so, I definitely started to become a bit less comfortable about the fact of eating meat, whether that was from people around me going vegetarian for ethical reasons, general consciousness about the impact of meat eating on the climate, and so on. But I...
You met somebody. You gave it up for love.
In a sense. Okay. So on the one hand, I had been kind of uncomfortable about meeting meat, but it wasn't until I started living with a vegan that I really just kind of stopped eating meat by sort of necessity in a way. It just wasn't, you know, we weren't going to eat meat together, so we didn't. And it was very interesting. What I found during that time was that, yeah, little by little, it kind of felt more and more impossible for me to eat meat. What had already been kind of in my mind as a sort of seed of disquiet became a kind of impossibility. And I found that it really opened up what I was able to confront in terms of the actual politics of meat eating, the politics behind meat production, as well as the politics behind meat consumption. And that was really interesting to me, how the kind of act of eating sort of unlocked something in both how I was able to kind of, how deep I was able to go in thinking about meat, but also just in transforming my kind of experience of what it means to have a food system that culminates in killing other creatures and consuming them.
And so, I mean, yeah, you really do go into this kind of political, social construct behind the eating of meat. And you start off looking at this book, Pig Earth, which came out in 1979. Mm. Tell us about that. It was also a film.
It was also a film, yes. So this was a book written by John Berger, who is a writer, art historian. He's probably most famous for the TV series Ways of Seeing, which is also a book. Poet, leftist activist. Anyway, he wrote this book, Pig Earth. It's kind of a collection of stories, vignettes drawn from his experience living among a peasant community in rural France. And I first came across this book actually when I was having a discussion. I was having a discussion with some friends about our own meat eating and kind of the sort of absurdities involved in our relationships with animals and meat. And a friend was describing this scene in Pig Earth where a peasant farmer and their family kill the pig that they are going to eat for the whole of the winter. And he talks about how Berger talks about how, but also my friend was describing how, you know, they kill the pig, but they love the pig. And there's this kind of very sort of profound and beautiful sounding collision of love and killing. And, you know, this seemed like a very, you know, this is a very interesting idea to me and it was very compelling. But then, you know, after a moment of reflection, I was just thinking, but we're not peasant farmers. Like, you and I are not peasant farmers. So what does it mean for us to be kind of spouting this idea at the dinner table? And, you know, are you and I actually, you know, loving and respecting an animal when we're eating it, even if we're eating it kind of very consciously and reverentially, in the same way as, you know, we might just love steak. And I think these things often get confused sometimes. Mm. And so a lot of what the book is about how certain kinds of stories that we tell ourselves, both through visual culture and also, you know, literary culture, general kind of discourse, media discourse, you know, from TV to advertising to films, can kind of mystify the class relations that are involved in not just the food system, but the economic system as a whole.
And I'd like to unpick that. You write, with the intensification of capitalist production comes the intensification of both human and animal exploitation. Tell us more about your feelings around that.
Yeah, so this is kind of one of the things that I hadn't really managed to wrap my head around that kind of clearly until I had stopped eating meat myself, because I see myself as a very politicized person. You know, I'm interested in and engaged in kind of labor politics and so forth. And yet, I think I had for a long time been profoundly depoliticized around meat. And what I discovered, or what I was able to recognize in researching this book and thinking about it a bit more deeply and trying to sort of connect the dots, is that really, you know, meat could be seen ultimately as the kind of most extreme, or perhaps the kind of ultimate expression of our capitalist system of production and of capitalism's class system, in as much as in order for value to accumulate and in order to make profit from the food system, certain hierarchies have to be established where some lives are considered more worthwhile than others. And we see that in kind of labor conditions, but then ultimately in the way that animals are used as workers and used as commodities. And yeah, as I was kind of hinting, the furthest logical extension of that kind of devaluation of certain kinds of life, you know, where certain kinds of people and animals are made into things, is to kill them and, you know, kill them for profit, kill them for pleasure, sometimes for necessity, you know, for necessities of human survival. But I think that often the extent to which that necessity is produced by our economic system rather than by some kind of more primordial, you know, tragic necessity often gets obscured in the ways that we present our relationship with meat.
And you talked about advertising. You also talked about the way that meat is presented to us. And one of the ways, and class indeed, one of the ways that this happens is through television programmes. And you focus on Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall, which I think is really interesting. So he's the man behind Escape to the River Cottage.
Yeah.
Tell us why that was important.
Yeah, so the way that I kind of contextualise this initial focus on River Cottage, which, you know, now I kind of view with a lot of fondness. I think that, you know, I obviously pick it apart a lot in the book, but there is a certain kind of levity and humour in that programme and a sort of knowingness about the kind of performance that is being given that I think has kind of got a little bit lost in recent years where people have tried to emulate that same kind of thing. But anyway, what I talk about in the book is how this kind of return to the land discourse that emerges kind of when this kind of awareness of the urban disconnection from the realities of agriculture, animal agriculture, begins to really get lost with kind of hyper-industrialization and a kind of, yeah, extremely globalized, hyper-commoditized food system. Programs like River Cottage emerge to kind of reacquaint us, sort of urban, you know, ignorant urban actors with, yeah, the origins of our food, the realities of farming, the actual kinds of things that farmers have to consider, the sort of deep relationship with the land and with animal life that is involved in kind of bringing up livestock and certain aspects of the economic necessity involved in that. And, you know, to some extent, that's, you know, that's great. That's really important. I think that, you know, in the programme, Hugh does to some extent model a very kind of caring and loving attitude to the animals in River Cottage. But at the same time, what kind of gets obscured in that kind of performance is the fact that, you know, both the maker of the program is not in fact subject to the kinds of economic necessity that he is performing, and that actually there is a lot more that we could hope for in transforming our food system than this kind of nostalgic return to a sort of almost kind of feudal arrangement whereby, you know, people make the best of conditions of extreme kind of subjugation. Mm. Like there's even this, I mean, it's dealt with in this very strange way, but, you know, there's even an episode where he kind of dresses up as a medieval peasant and there's this kind of playful kowtowing to his landlords and all of this, which, yeah, kind of mystifies the fact that there are still kind of extreme relations of subjugation, exploitation, and almost kind of neo-feudalism that happens in the way that our food is produced. And I think, yeah, this kind of extends both to how food is produced and also how it is consumed. I think often we forget what kinds of need we're talking about when we talk about our need to eat meat as well as our need to produce and sell meat.
Tell me what you mean by the meat paradox.
The meat paradox. Okay, so the meat paradox is a kind of phrase that emerges in sort of a lot of literature that kind of fairly reasonably earnestly tries to unpick the strange situation whereby humans can really love animals but also really love meat, essentially. And the way that I talk about this in the book is I have a chapter on tragedy as a kind of one of three aesthetic tropes that I discuss that are used to kind of create this image of our relationship with meat as one that is loving in this very kind of profound, deeply intellectual, primal kind of way. And yeah, I talk about the parallel between discussions of this meat paradox and this kind of paradox of tragedy that is discussed in literary criticism, whereby viewers of theatrical tragedy can find something both extremely painful but also extremely pleasurable to watch. And I think that what this kind of melding of paradox and tragedy in our kind of discourse and imagery around meat does is it creates this sense that there is a kind of eternal, transhistorical necessity going on in our relationship with meat, whereas in fact what tragic drama stages very often is a kind of contingent exercise of power, and how what's complicated when we watch tragedy is our kind of aesthetic response to it. But actually, the power dynamics that are at play are very, very simple. There's a kind of exercise of might, you know, whereby one person is, violence is done to one person and therefore they will do violence to someone, you know, further down the chain from them. So yeah, what can be made to look very paradoxical can actually sometimes be mapped quite kind of straightforwardly onto a kind of system of power. And I think that's what's happening often, both in the meat industry and in the kind of culture around meat consumption. Mm.
So tragedy, you then go on to harmony. Yeah. Tell us about meat and harmony.
Yeah, so harmony, that chapter kind of moves from this idea of the more cosmic relationship with meat to the kind of more towards the mechanics of meat production. And this narrative of harmony is often mobilized to describe the kind of ecological relationship between humans and animals, and also humans and the planet, humans and the land. And what often emerges is this picture of this very harmonious symbiosis between animals and humans, where we care for animals and, you know, they give us something in return, and it all kind of fits within this wonderful circle of life that we all know about. And kind of that's that. And, you know, that justifies not, I think it's often counterposed to the sort of horrors of industrial factory farming, but is used to kind of describe this very bucolic image of organic farming and small scale farming and, you know, potentially much more loving ways of producing meat.
Conscious eating.
Conscious eating. Yes, exactly. Conscious farming, conscious eating. And I think there are, you know, there are lots of complicated things going on here, but ultimately, I think the sort of this image of care that is being described is kind of at best a very limited one, and at its worst can potentially be quite a dangerous one, in that it's an image of care that clearly culminates in a very one-sided relationship, whereby we kind of reward ourselves for animals' dependency on us by helping ourselves to their flesh and their milk, you know, their secretions and so on. And I think, you know, we see a lot of parallels here in the disabilities studies scholar Sunara Taylor writes really brilliantly on this, about how this discourse or this language of dependency has been used to justify all manner of violences throughout history, from slavery to disability oppression to patriarchy. And, you know, if we take a step back and think with a little bit less of an agenda about kind of what care or mutual dependency might actually mean, you know, we might find that there are other ways of living harmoniously with animals that didn't involve us sort of assuming that they are willing to make this ultimate sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And I think that the language of love does a lot of work in that regard. You know, lots of terrible things can be done in the name of love. And, you know, love can be a very politically loaded concept and, you know, can do a lot of work to obscure the ways in which love doesn't always mean that, you know, there are no relationships of power, or that the thing that somebody is giving us is being given completely willingly.
Beauty. You also look at beauty. And you talk about, well, you start by the trend of eating bone marrow, actually, and Anthony Bourdain, and how all of that was sort of popularised. And also the sort of, I don't know, beautifully shot pictures and things we see of meat. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so here I'm kind of moving more towards the sort of culture around eating meat, this sort of sophisticated dining culture that makes something very beautiful of meat in order to sort of, well, not necessarily in order to, because that makes it sound like it's kind of absolutely cynical, which I don't think it always is. I think sometimes these things can be kind of unwitting, but that, yeah, makes something very precious of meat by aestheticizing it in a certain way, so that the kind of commodity value of this meat, of luxury meat, of meat that is sold in kind of, you know, whether it's luxurious subscription meat boxes or whether it's in, you know, expensive, awful restaurants, you know, that sort of allied the commodity value of that thing with the preciousness of the life that was involved in giving us that commodity. And yeah, it's interesting that often these kind of beautified images of meat combine this very rarefied aesthetic with a kind of, I think I quote the first St. John cookbook from the St. John restaurant in Smithfields in London, which is a very popular chic restaurant championing nose-to-tail eating, that describes, their first book describes, I think it's combining, I can't remember what the exact phrase is, but it's something sophistication with peasant roughness. So again, there's this kind of appropriation of a certain kind of, yeah, peasant's relationship with the animal, with a kind of middle class diner's relationship with, you know, delicious cuts of meat served at a high price in a very different kind of spirit from the peasant feast, as it were. So, yes, that's really kind of, that's the premise for the chapter on beauty. And I think, you know, what's interesting about this is this idea that I think, you know, is quite a compelling one, that, but also kind of on closer examination becomes quite a nonsensical one, that, you know, we could somehow satisfy, you know, if we really savour the preciousness of this beautiful thing that we're being made to eat, then that represents at least some kind of respect for the animal whose life has been given to our meal. And this is the idea behind nose-to-tail eating, where it would be, the idea is it would be disingenuous to the animal not to eat the whole thing. And when you start to think about this in terms of ideas of beauty and consumption and satisfaction, it kind of raises the question of, you know, why should we believe that by filling ourselves up on the beauty of something, that should ever satisfy our desire for it, rather than fuel our desire for this thing. You know, we will never be full of beauty. Beauty is something kind of very distinct from the kind of necessities of nourishment or even the pleasure of nourishment. You know, it's something much more kind of cerebral and intangible and potentially limitless.
And of course, the climate crisis comes into this too.
Yeah, that idea that, you know, there is this inexhaustible well of natural resources for us to plunder, which I think, yeah, the climate crisis exposes as being absolutely not true. And that, I think that really connects very strongly back to the book's central argument about capitalism, because, you know, nature is kind of capitalism's ostensibly non-commodifiable support, you know, in order, but one that we have managed to kind of commodify anyway. You know, we treat nature as something that doesn't have a cost. And I think those costs, the devastating costs of that attitude, are being exposed to us in the climate crisis, as well as in the worst kind of cruelties that we see in industrial farming.
Amber, what do you want the reader to take away from this book? Do you want us to forswear meat? Do you just want us to be more conscious about how we eat? Or is it something else?
Yeah, that's a brilliant question. I definitely am not here to tell people, you know, you must just stop eating meat and that's that. And, you know, that's going to save the world, because I really don't believe that that's true. But I think that in some sense, transforming our relationship with animal life, and I do think that often that can happen very powerfully through changing our relationship with food, is a necessary, if kind of insufficient, condition to doing the much kind of more extensive and serious work that is required to transform not just our entire food system, but our entire economic order. So I really see changing our relationship with animal life and, you know, changing our relationship with meat, not kind of as an end in itself, but as a form of politicization to kind of really think deeply about what political work needs to be done to make that transformation. So ultimately, I think what that involves, or what that will involve and is already involving to some extent, is, you know, coalition building between the animal rights movement, but also the labor movement, the climate justice movement, and the food justice movement, among others, to completely transform this social order, which has culminated in kind of limitless making of meat. There's no amount of kind of creating a niche market for ethical meat within that system is going to save us from the system as a whole, which infinitely, by devaluing life, you know, necessitates more and more and cheaper meat.
And I mean, in a way, this feeds into so much else that we're looking at the moment. I think for centuries, we have all been used to a certain way of seeing various things, whether it be perhaps imperialism and empire, the way that people view Britain, or indeed modern democracy, which seems to be changing, or even technology, which is now seen as more of a threat than a help. It seems to me that there is a definite move now towards examining things that we have just accepted for centuries. What do you think has prompted that fact that finally we're taking a step back going, hang on, we might have always done this, but now we need to have another look?
I definitely think the apocalyptic discourse around the climate helps. Yeah, there's definitely a sense that, you know, if something doesn't change, there will be terrible consequences. But I think that, you know, we can also think about not just how to kind of save the world that we already have, but how to kind of completely transform that world. You know, we don't have to make do with the world as we already have it and kind of try and save the status quo in the way that I think that a lot of the kind of conversation around meat has been formed by thus far. This kind of clinging to the idea of how we can keep eating meat but eat less meat. And I suppose, yeah, what the kind of catastrophe, the climate catastrophe, but also the kind of pure horrors that we're seeing in the way that agriculture, animal agriculture has developed, is this kind of, you know, something which in a sense is too horrible to kind of look away from and try and save. So now the question becomes, how do we create a society in which these things would not just have to be limited, but just would be unthinkable in the first place? And I think that's, you know, for all it's very depressing that that's how we've got here, that's a kind of very exciting thought in some ways.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think in generations, perhaps not that many generations, we will go, my God, people actually kept animals in captivity and then killed them and ate them.
Yeah, let's hope. Yeah, let's hope that's how we'll look at it. Yeah.
Oh, dear. OK, it's rice and beans for me.
I'm so sorry about that.
Amber Hussain, many thanks for coming on to talk to us.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Meat Love, An Ideology of the Flesh is published by the independent visual arts publisher MAC. You've been listening to Monocle Reads. Thanks to the producer, Nora Hall, and the studio manager, Mariella Bevan. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or your preferred podcast platform. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.